This is the Working Drummer Podcast, featuring conversations with ground-level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Albetta, and this week I'm talking with Jay Belleros. Jay is an aficionado and practitioner of all things old, gritty, and soulful, and was on the vanguard of drummers who began bringing vintage drums and sounds into modern music. His unique aesthetic has found a home both on stage and in the studio with Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, T-Bone Burnett, Ray LaMontagne, Bonnie Raitt, Paula Cole, and many others. He also plays in guitarist Molly Miller's trio with his wife Jennifer Condos on bass. Our Patreon content now features our recent guest Pat Petrillo discussing the recording of his version of Black Cow for his new record. We've also got lots of other drummers on that Patreon series, including Ash Sohn and Will Kennedy, talking about specific songs they've tracked drums for and all the technical and creative aspects of those recording processes. You can get access to this and the rest of our Patreon content for as little as $1 a month, so check that out. We'd really appreciate your support. Again, that's patreon.com/workingdrummer. If you're in the Pacific Northwest, I'll be in the area with Ain't Too Proud at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, January 24th to February 5th, and Keller Auditorium Hall in Portland, February 6th to the 12th. Go to ain'ttooproudmusical.com for more info, and please hit me up if you're coming. I'd love to meet up and say hi. So Jay has really created his own time zone on the drumming landscape, and he's a great example of having confidence in his approach and having the patience to find situations where it belongs. Both his perspective and the way he expresses it are esoteric and poetic and funny, and I had a great time talking with him. So here we go. Hope you dig Jay Belleros. Is this early for you?
You know, I get up early these days. I used to be, I've always been a night owl, and I've tried to readjust during the pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, I'd go to bed at 5 in the morning or something like that.
Sitting in here listening to records?
Yeah, practicing and stuff. I mean, people can't hear me, so I mean, we have really cool neighbors, so I just did whatever I wanted to do.
Right.
But now I'm on an early schedule. But with that said, I'm still, yeah, it's still foggy. I have a theory, and you know, I was born at 6:01 p.m., I think it was the exact time. And I think that's when my day starts. And I've always felt that way, even when I was a kid.
Around 6 p.m. is when
I feel like I can handle other humans. And I'm not going to be, you know... I don't get worried. Because I'm in my room. So
right, but that's funny. I need some time before I can handle other humans. Regardless of what time I get up, you know, I have kind of a routine in the morning, and
yeah.
When that routine is complete, it's like, okay, I'm ready to go now. But it's good to, my wife gives me shit all the time.
Jennifer knows now that she can't ask me questions in the morning.
Right, right. And it's good to know that someone's ready to go time is later than mine.
Yeah, it takes me a while. And it sometimes, like I said, it takes to about a normal dinner time for people, like 6 o'clock or whatever.
Yeah.
Where I just feel, and now even on an early schedule, if I go to bed early, I feel a little gypped, because that time of night is when I start to feel really good about everything.
Right. So how has that affected your, I'm sure you've had to, do endless sessions during the day. Do you have to, engineer your...
Yeah, there's a lot of coffee involved. Used to be a lot of coffee involved, not so much anymore. Driving to the studio, there's always some kind of meditation going on. And just keep it together, just go in and
right.
Be cool.
Right. So we don't often do a ton of geeking out on gear on this podcast, but I do want to start by talking about your setup with Robert Plant and Allison Krauss.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you a few months ago at Chastain Amphitheater in Atlanta, and you were super gracious and generous to get Christina and I the tickets and the passes, and it was one of the best concerts I've ever seen. Best in recent memory, just from a performance standpoint, from a sound standpoint.
We have an ace.
Yeah.
Sound guy that he cares so much.
Yeah.
He was so prepared when he came in and remarkable. I feel very safe in his hands.
Yes. So let's just start by talking about what it is you're playing on that tour.
It's a Rolling Bomber drum set made by Slingerland in the 40s, World War II time.
Mm-hmm.
And there, there's lots of information online, but the gist of the story is that there was metal rationing going on, so a lot of the components on this drum set is made, it's made of rosewood or walnut, or really hard wood.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big, warm sound that comes out of these things.
Yeah.
And I stumbled on them by accident years ago. I purchased them with Ray LaMontagne in mind. I was about to go on the road. Jennifer and I both were about to go tour with him.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to his music, and I had just started to get onto eBay and start that horrible habit of lots of bidding.
Yeah.
And I was listening to his music, and scrolling through all the drum sets, and this drum set, beautiful drum set, came up, and it was, I think the seller didn't want to sell the drums. I could tell it was just by how much he cared about. There's a big write up on it and a beautiful composed photograph.
Yeah.
Of the drums on I think he lived on a farm. There was a barn in the background and a pickup truck, and then the drums were under this big beautiful tree. And they just looked like the music was sounding to me. They looked like they needed to be part of. And so that's kind of why I got those drums in the first place.
Right.
And it immediately was, there was a connection.
Yeah.
And a very strange connection, too, because I feel like they are alive. they're really temperamental and they're very moody. Mm-hmm. And right off the bat, I found that out the
right
way,
Yeah. Were the original heads still on it?
Yes. And I made the big mistake of taking them off, which I had to tap them off because they'd been on there since the 40s, I think.
Wow.
And there were, lots of, there's some voodoo dust that just came out of these things, and I probably shouldn't have let that out. But because they were very difficult for about 3 or 4 days, and when I put, first of all, I didn't know anything about these drums, and not nobody really did, mm-hmm. you know. And I tried to put Remo heads on the drums, and they wouldn't fit.
Right.
And that's when I started getting hip to the American vintage heads, because they're designed for that purpose.
Right.
And they fit, but when I tightened them all up, they didn't make a sound. You know, the shells are kind of out of round and all of that
yeah.
business. And I was just trying to get the ripples out of the head,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when I did that, there was no tuning involved. They were just, you know, just tight and not toneful and mm-hmm. very choked. And I had had these drums shipped to my sister's house in Maine because I was about to rehearse and meet Ray for the first time in Portland, Maine.
Huh.
So the drums showed up, and I take them out, took the heads off, put these other heads on. You know, I scrambled for about 3 days, and the drums were not making any sound.
Ugh.
And an hour before the rehearsal, the drums weren't making any sound.
Oh, God.
I went in the car, I went to the rehearsal with Jennifer. We met Ray, talked for an hour before we played a note. I set the drums up, and I'm thinking, I know that these drums aren't going to work. And I'm just praying at this point, you know. So, you know, he suggested that we start rehearsing. And
yeah, yeah.
I went over to the drums, and I swear to God, I sat behind them, and they opened up.
Wow. They
sound, you know, the way they sound now.
Right, right.
But they, that's when I knew these things were going to give me a hard time. They were in charge. And I tell everybody, Tex and everybody that I work with, that they're in charge,
right.
you know.
Right.
And don't tune them if they're not sounding good at sound check. Just leave them. They're going to change.
Yeah.
And usually, like clockwork, by showtime, you know, they're like me. You know, they wake up in the evening.
Yeah, don't talk to the drums before 6.
Exactly. You know? And they just, you know, there are days where they're not firing on all cylinders. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes the rack tom's not happening. And I just play whatever sounds good on a given day. And then once in a while, they're all just rocking. They're all just perfect and sounding great.
Right. You know? It seemed like Atlanta was one of those nights. I don't...
yeah, yeah. I mean, they usually sound really good, but then there are days where they're unbelievably beautiful.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know? So in terms of... I mean, I can't imagine taking... You talk about how temperamental those drums are. I mean... I can't imagine taking a drum set like that on tour. Like, what special considerations?
Well, I spent more in the road cases.
Yeah.
Than I did those drums at the time. I want to say they weren't more than $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, I went to buy a second Rolling Bomber set. Probably my fault. You know, after 3 or 4 years of working with Robert Plant and Alison Krauss and a pretty high profile, people were seeing me play these drums, and a lot of people were curious about them. So when I went to buy another set, it was about $6,000.
Yeah.
And now I think they're even creeping up a little bit more.
Yeah, know? Yeah. So just...
But the road cases have been great. I mean, that's my working set. You know, that's the one I had on the road. And it's not in pristine shape. It wasn't in pristine shape when I got it. The set that I've spent $6,000 on is immaculate. And it has the original wooden legs on the floor tom and a matching... Wow. That set on the road doesn't have a matching floor tom. I bought that aside.
Okay.
It has a different finish.
Got it.
It's got a white marine pearl finish. But that set works really well on the road. And I don't mind... You know, it's getting chewed up a little bit, but it's like Willie Nelson's guitar.
Right.
Which I don't have a problem with. They just keep gluing it back together.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. So in terms of, you know, miking this kit and capturing your sound on it, you mentioned your audio guy. What is his name again?
Mark Kennedy.
Right. Running sound for you. And talk about the... the set of mics that y'all are using to capture that kit and the conversation around how to capture that sound.
The details of the I'm really bad with audio gear. And knowing, let's see.
Well, aside from,
I can tell you that the bass drum has a Sennheiser mounted inside of it, one of those flat mics, like what are those,
91. Oh, the Shure, Beta 91.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And he has the football mic on the outside, I think. He told me he was favoring the inside mic for the most part, which is interesting because I never knew it to be a pleasing sound.
Yeah.
It always sounded like a big beach ball, but he figured out some way of dialing it in. He's a magician. I don't really know how. So I've done a few gigs since then. I've seen other mic setups. I think he had the big blocky old school Tom mics, the Sennheisers.
Oh yeah, the 421s.
421s.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe he's using 421s. I can't remember what he had above me.
There was a big overhead, a single overhead, and I couldn't tell.
It might be one of those, like those AEA stereo kind of.
Yeah, deals. I figured that's what it was.
Yeah, on the first tour they used something like that. That they figured out that was like a really good way of capturing me.
Yeah, yeah. And like without getting into the weeds too much about, the tech of it all, my overall takeaway from that concert was that it's kind of minimal miking on the drum set. Like there aren't a ton of mics
right
on the drums. And it goes along with just, I think, the aesthetic of like your playing and that drum set, like just capture the whole sound. We don't need to isolate stuff. We don't need to worry about like bleed too much.
There was a little bit of, conversation with not so much for me, but baffling some of the amps and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I don't play super hard.
Right, that's another thing I noticed. The sounds coming off the stage were obviously super huge, but
those drums, they can take some power, but they really, the lighter you play them, the bigger they sound.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that to be true for most drums or
those? I find that to be true for most instruments. And it's something I learned from watching really great bluegrass players and people who play mandolins and acoustic guitars, and if you hit those instruments, especially the old instruments, too hard, they just collapse. And they sound like a maraca, or you lose the body of the sound.
Right.
So when I got these bomber drums, they allowed me to play that way. Like I could play really soft.
Right. Right.
And I used that drum set on most of the Raising Sand, the first Raising Sand record.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was done with my hands.
Wow.
And they just cranked me up.
Yeah.
Boosted me up.
Wow, that's amazing. I was talking with Matt Starr yesterday about how more and more drummers are, gaining expertise and experience recording themselves and engineering their own sessions. And Matt sort of speculated that is leading to drummers having more of a say in a recording session or in a live miking situation. There's more of a conversation happening with sound engineers. Because Matt's whole point was like, a sound engineer, no matter who they are, cannot possibly know my drums as well as I do.
Right.
Like, I've put in way more time, playing and recording these drums. And so I have an intimate knowledge that then the sound engineer can benefit from. Our intimate knowledge combined with their expertise is leading to drummers having, like I said, more of a say in you know, how the drums are mic'd and just the whole process. Have you found that to be true? It seems like you have that relationship with...
Yeah, well, I'm at a point now where I've had a chance to present the way I hear things.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's out there now.
Yeah.
And it's because, I mean, T-Bone Burnett was, he really noticed or paid attention and liked what I did, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Without a lot of conversation off the right initially, you know. And I just, I had a lot of room to develop. And they were, he and the engineer, Mike Persante, is really brilliant engineer. They were really working on low end and like everything that I was really into. I just walked in and they were kind of ready. Mm-hmm. And I sort of all found it together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And on a loose level, I could pay attention to the way they capture me. So if I go off and work with people that aren't too familiar with me, then I can guide them a little bit. But what is happening now is, you know, I'm getting hired mainly because of a lot of those records that I played on that T-Bone produced.
Right.
You know, and also Joe Henry as well. Like, he was a big, he was another outlet for me where I could just have freedom to, mm-hmm. to explore. But I, you know, T-Bone really took the plunge for me because I moved out here. I was floundering for a couple years and I couldn't get arrested out here. No one, they would just run for the hills when they saw me with wow. these dusty old drums.
And, yeah, yeah. When did you move out here?
I moved out here, I got going, it was probably like 99 and then 2000 is when I settled.
Okay.
Sort of.
Okay.
But I was a little lost for a couple of years, you know, and then I started meeting like-minded people, and then I got into that orbit with, you know, Sam Phillips and T-Bone and Joe Henry and Jennifer. Yeah. I met Jennifer, which was huge.
Right, you know,
on
right.
a lot of levels, but, so, yeah, I was able to really explore and develop, but now I'm at a point now where unless it's just horribly wrong from the get-go, I like to let engineers, I'm open to a different interpretation of it too. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, the guidance I always give is the proximity in my ears. That's how I hear things, to the drum set.
Right.
That's the way I'm playing. That's right. The way I want to hear it.
Yeah. Know?
And maybe close miking is for filler or to, but I'm making the sound that I want to hear.
Right.
And I think if engineers agree with that, then it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I'm getting hired because of that sound more, you know what I mean? Like before I had to fight for it, I had to,
right.
People weren't convinced that you could go play a rock session on an old set from the 40s, you know,
yeah.
And I've done it
a thousand times.
Yeah. It's my version of it. And it's not, it's a different version of it, but it, you know, and if you like that version of it, that's it.
Right. Right.
I got it for you.
So when you say you had to fight for it, were engineers or producers trying to capture your sound in a way that, you know, would fit with a modern set but didn't work for a vintage set, or were they trying to convince you to play modern drums, or
yeah, a little of everything? But what I found, and it's still true, you know, people have a tendency to listen with their eyes.
Yes.
For so sure. They see some gnarly drums come through the door and they can't imagine that's going to sound right. But I know that it's going to sound right because I'll prepare for them. I listen to the music. I pick the instruments that I think are going to work for the record.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just, you can, this big old bass drum over here, you can make that sound as small as you want it to sound, mm-hmm. and as tight, mm-hmm. you know. And it's a more interesting sound than actually using a small bass drum.
Right.
You can't take a small bass drum and make it sound like that.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time, I would bring that just for range, you know. And if it needed to be like old school, like kind of single-headed drum with the pillow, and, you know, I can do that.
Right.
I can find it with that
right.
drum.
Well, it speaks to what Matt was talking about in terms of just knowing our instruments and having, you know, this intimate familiarity.
That's exactly
with them.
Right.
And yeah. it seems like, you know, with your bag and the whole the whole vintage thing, at least as far as LA is concerned, you know, maybe you were kind of one of the first ones through the wall and got a little bit bloody.
Yeah, yeah, but, maybe. I mean, I think, you know, it all changed as soon as I got T-Bone's blessing.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, all of a sudden, there was an understanding,
right?
Which is kind of funny to me.
Right,
because it was always there. You know, it didn't change. You know,
what didn't change?
My approach.
Yeah,
my love for, you know, that I'm gonna bring old drums into a session.
Right,
you know, right. And. I feel like they're gonna sound good.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to. I mean, if you want modern drums, and there's lots of people who do that.
Yeah.
You know, you just get the thing that I learned from T-Bone too is just, it just casts. You get the right people for the job.
It's casting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you like this world, this all of this old stuff, then I got plenty of it. You
know? Yeah, yeah. Was the Robert Plant, Alison Krauss thing the first? Was it kind of your first go around with T-Bone? Was that the project that he?
No.
What was it that he kind of like anointed you and said, "I want your thing."
the first session I did was for the really great songwriter Sam Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
It was on a record called Boot and a Shoe, and that made the connection. And shortly after that, he invited me to play. He was making a solo record at the time called True False Identity, and he loves drums. He really loves drums. So that record had three drummers playing live together on the floor.
Oh, how
so
cool.
It was me, Jim Keltner, and Carla Azar.
Jesus.
If you haven't listened to that record, you should
yeah.
check it out.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Jim's down the middle, and I might be like on the left, and she's on the right. I did a lot of double drumming
mm-hmm.
for a while in T-Bone's world. The Robert Plant Alison Krauss record was the first record that I did alone,
mm-hmm.
and it was horrifying. You know, it's that. I think we all have those moments where, you know, you go to a session and you think today's the day. Everyone's going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing. Right. You know what I mean? It's just that weird. Those voices start happening.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I really had that feeling on that session. Mm-hmm. I walked in there going, okay, there's no. Jim's going to get a call tomorrow, I'm sure. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And rescue me. But, you know, there's something about fear that pushes you along, you know?
Mm-hmm. Talk more about that. Like,
you don't have many choices, you know?
Right.
You can either just walk out. And that's that, and that's not a good look.
You know? Right.
I mean, I love playing drums too much to. I'm in a room with these incredible musicians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dennis Crouch on bass, you know, he was on the tour.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mark Rebo. And
yeah, like that, fuck, you know? Man.
And I think it was more that. Like, those guys were going to go, oh, no, I wish Kellner were here. I wish some, you know, just.
So at that time, like, you were relatively new. You were relatively unknown to all these guys in that world.
Yeah, I mean, I had another life elsewhere, you know, early on. There's a singer named Paula Cole that I kind of got started mm-hmm. with on the road. It was my first big record that I made years ago in the 90s and then my first touring and everything, and we were like brother and sister, you know, so we I spent a lot of time with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I moved out here, she took time off to have a family, and I just went into this whole other zone, and that's when I found myself in that world.
Yeah. How long was that session?
The Raising Sand session?
Yeah.
I want to say maybe it was a week.
Okay.
I think I was supposed to be there for a couple weeks.
Right.
But we finished ahead of time. I believe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm so foggy about these things.
And was the band all together? Were Robert and Allison sing along?
Yeah, it was all going down, you know, and then they would fix stuff and, you know, go in and sometimes maybe not, you know.
Had you met either of them before this project?
No. It's funny because, I mean, now everybody's familiar with and agrees that those voices work really well together.
Yeah.
They sound beautiful.
Yeah.
They really sound beautiful. But I don't know, way back when this first happened, there were a lot of skeptics. And I wasn't skeptical, but I just didn't think that of putting those two singers together. So when I first got called, I thought I was going to Nashville to do a Robert Plant record first,
mm-hmm.
and then I would do an Alison Krauss record after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the first day, they were both there, and they started singing together. I realized, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
This is interesting.
Wow.
And I think, you know, they talk about this, that they just wanted to give it a go, and after a few days, if it wasn't working, they just move on from it. But some with that particular group of musicians and with T-Bone and something that hit a spark, you know, they just kind of
for sure
started moving.
Yeah.
And that's one of those moments in my life as a musician. As I was going to I've heard these stories from other people, but as I was going to the airport, Robert called me, and he was really excited. And then he asked me if I would be available to tour. And the record, you know, hadn't even been. We'd just done the
initial
track.
You just got done with the
session.
But there
was an energy about it.
Yeah.
You know? And I just felt like this is a special moment.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening with this particular crew?
Yeah.
And these two incredible singers.
Yeah. And so in terms of the fear that you mentioned, was it, I mean, I would imagine there was just sort of an intimidation factor with Robert fucking Plant. right there.
Yeah, he was very nice, though. Like, he diffuses a lot of that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's inevitable. You know, even if things are going well, you're going to hit a snag at some point, right. You know, and just it's knowing how to tuck and roll, you know what I mean? Be able to take a fall,
yeah,
like the vaudeville actors, you know.
Right, right.
And you don't hurt yourself. But so I just try to stay positive and keep moving and really be in the moment and appreciate that, Jesus, look where I am.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was a kid in Maine with that Zeppelin poster on my bedroom wall.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
And then, there aren't too many singers better than Alison Krauss.
Yeah, they're both of them are just incredible.
It's such a gift to be able to be in the middle. And it's interesting.
I mean, I was going to ask.
Two different worlds, you know. I mean, in like, a way, you know. They're,
with the two different singers?
Yeah, yeah. Different styles, you know.
For sure.
I mean, now they're kind of fusing into this whole other sound, you know.
Yeah. But I know what you mean about it being two different worlds. And, like, from the audience perspective, you know, over the course of the concert, sometimes you're in Robert's world and sometimes you're in Allison's world. And like you said, sometimes you're in this combined fusion of the two together. But there's space for all three of those things.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout the concert.
No, and that's what makes it really, you know, exciting. And
do you ever sit back there and think, like, I'm sitting where John Bonham sat?
Yeah. Yeah, because there are times, you know, where, you know, obviously, there have been some years that have gone by since the Zeppelin days, but
yeah,
when the light catches, you know, Robert's hair, you know, it's the same hair, you know.
Dude, it was incredible. And it's the same voice. I mean, he sounds different, obviously, and he uses his voice in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think
his physicality on stage, his movements too. Like, I remember when we first started rehearsing for the first tour, T-Bone made the comment of, yeah, I mean, watch his shoulder, you know, Bonham's foot on his bass drum is in his shoulder, you know.
Wow.
Like he could just feel that pop, you know, he just has a swagger, has a groove.
I love that you mentioned that, because one of my favorite things about playing with singers is to kind of figure out where their physicality is. Because, like, most singers will just dance in some way that sort of tells you what they're feeling or what they need. And, you know, sometimes you have to pay attention and watch them really close. Other times, you know, somebody will just tell you, like, this is what they do. Watch out for it.
Yeah.
Well,
I find that way, that's the case with musicians in general, too. I like to get an idea of where people hold the time in their body.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And some people are moving their feet, but you don't want to follow their feet.
Right.
Recently, I've been having dental work done because of, you know, my grinding my teeth.
Oh, wow.
You know, and the dentist just wanted to give me a night guard and said, okay, you're grinding your teeth at night. And I realized that, like, I don't know if it's all happening at night.
Mm, yeah.
You know, because my whole life I've always, it was a time when I was a kid, I didn't have a drum set. So I would walk around with music and drums in my head, and I'd play drums with my teeth.
Like, I did that too.
Like floor tom on this side, and you know what I mean?
Snare yeah. Them.
And I was moving like around the drum set with my teeth. So,
wow.
So yeah, it wears it.
I didn't have a whole drum set in my mouth. I just kind of would click. Like I would.
Oh yeah,
just
no, I would. Sometimes I would just visualize, you know, going around a drum set.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then, you know, play like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So anyway, so I'm really interested in where people hold the time.
Yeah.
You know?
And, what about Allison? Like,
she doesn't move a whole lot.
That's true. She doesn't.
She's swaying a little bit these days, but
yeah.
I toured with her before the pandemic, just with her guys, you know, with the bluegrass band, and none of those guys moved.
Mm.
I mean, I try not to move, but it's hard because I keep time with movement.
Right. You know?
But
on April 27th, the Percussive Arts Society Tennessee chapter will present their annual Tennessee Day of Percussion event, hosted by Brian Fullen at Trevecca Nazarene University in Nashville, Tennessee, and is open to all drummers and enthusiasts. This incredible event features solo competitions in drum set, concert snare drum, and mallet keyboard. Online registration is now open to everyone who wants to participate. Visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register for this event, the competitions, or to register your percussion ensemble for the showcase. Grand prizes will be awarded to the contest winners, with door prizes raffled throughout the day. Sponsors include Yamaha, Zildjian, Remo, Innovative Percussion, Ludwig, Sabian, and many more. There will be clinics and performances throughout the day featuring Matt Billingsley, currently on the Eras Tour with Taylor Swift, marimba virtuoso and international soloist Andre Vinay, Bob Breithaupt, recognized as one of the nation's leaders in percussion education, and Keith Elio, director of percussion at the Interlochen Center for the Arts and consultant for the Avidus Zildjian Company. Ben Lupton from the Music City Mystique will also present a drumline clinic featuring the Victory Drumline, and Jeremy Chapman will present clinics on Irish drumming. Additionally, there will be collegiate and high school education ensemble showcases throughout the day, featuring the Tennessee All-State Percussion Ensemble. You don't want to miss this incredible opportunity to learn from world-class players and educators. Registration is now open. Tickets will also be available at the door, with registration opening at 8:30 a.m. day of event. Credit card only. Final reminder, visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register.
It's horrifying because I don't want to, when you're standing, when you're on stage with a bunch of people who don't move a whole lot, you look like a Muppet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was really trying to but it you get lost in the music, you know,
right.
And it's just, there are physical movements that I do that helps me with the space between the notes.
Yeah, for sure. And none of it seemed ostentatious. Like everybody, nobody stuck out. Everybody was just kind of.
Well, we got, you know, there's a little more. JD's, you know, he's kind of physical.
Yeah.
That helps. You know, Dennis, he's got that hand thing that he does.
Yeah.
Which is really beautiful. It's like a, you know, it's like a ballet.
Right.
But he stands so still.
Yep.
He doesn't move.
And Allison, like, you know, I've played with a million singers, and some of them are really like all over the stage. Some of them are incredibly physical and incredibly, you know, expressive in that way. And you can get a lot from that. But, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum is the singer like Allison, who just like holds a place.
Well, I love
and owns it.
Watching her from, you know, out in the audience sometimes. I think on that tour, I would go. I'd have like three or four songs I didn't play in the middle of the set, so sometimes I would go out front to see what it looked like and sounded like. And I love her delivery. It's like she's having a conversation with the audience.
Yeah.
She's looking around and really projecting the music to the people.
Yeah, yeah.
And like she's just talking to people.
Yeah.
And it's really riveting and beautiful.
It is, and it feels like it takes a ton of
doesn't feel like performing,
right? And it takes a lot of security not to perform, right? To just be there on stage.
Sure does.
And not be more than you are and not try too hard and just,
especially to go out. The first song we would do on that set, on her set, was a ballad. So you go out and sing a ballad. There was none of this, let's go and hand them over the head and, you know, do slow it down in the middle and then ramp it up again. There was a great deal of security and just going out there and pulling, getting people to lean in.
Right, right.
She's the best at that.
Yeah.
To just lean in and want to listen to her.
And then Robert hits everybody over the head.
Yeah, he likes to shake it up, for sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those two dynamics, it's tricky to be in the middle of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've over-exaggerated the story over the years, but it's very funny. it did happen often that I would run into disgruntled Zeppelin fans. I mean, they're always happy to hear Robert, but, you know, some of these guys are just pissed because Zeppelin's never going to get back together, you know, and they're trying to deal with it. And so the audience, and on the first record, everyone was just wrapping their heads around this combination.
Yeah.
So it was divided into three categories. So the disgruntled Zeppelin people, some of them were happy. The bluegrass.
Yeah.
Very strict about some of those bluegrass people. Drums are the devil.
Right. Right.
You know, because a bluegrass band is a drum set, and everyone has a role.
Yep.
In playing. I learned so much about how to play a drum set from watching these great bluegrass musicians. You mm-hmm. know? And then there were the people that knew the record and liked the record and accepted the record, and I was part of that. So that was my get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'd run in either the Zeppelin people would just go after me and complain that I didn't play hard enough. And
like to your face?
Yeah. It's just like, Jesus. Man, you know, why don't you play like Bonham? Why don't you hit those drums? It's funny because Bonham played like a jazz player. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't pile driving. He was dynamic.
Yes.
But he wasn't playing like a...
It wasn't like that all the time. Like, yeah. There are some videos of him, like, just absolute caveman, like, above his head, but I think most of the time...
Yeah, but toneful, though.
Yes.
Still toneful.
Yes.
You can still make tone with that kind of movement.
Yeah. And that wasn't his norm. That was the top of his range. You know, he also, like you said, he played so dynamically.
Yeah. You know, and there are drummers that crush the sound. They push the sound into the drums, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but he pulled things out. But anyway, they would get on my case about that. And then the bluegrass people, there was actually a woman that told me I was ruining Allison's career.
To your face.
To my face. Like, why are you playing drums with her? Like, you're ruining her sound and all, you know. And she, I mean, she has drums on her tours and stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, so there were those moments that would happen that I thought were really funny. But I just used it all in my approach. Mm-hmm. You know, like those are hard facts. It's where she's coming from, where he's coming from,
mm-hmm.
you know, where I'm coming from and how to approach all of this stuff, like how to provide enough power and enough sensitivity at the same time.
So interesting. So you get this criticism from the Zeppelin police and the bluegrass police. Yeah. And you know, my instinct would be to tell these people to fuck off, and then I'm not John Bonham. This isn't Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Alison Krauss likes drums. Like, yeah. This is what it is. Fucking deal with it. But it sounds like you kind of, like, took this into account and incorporated it into approach?
I just knew that, yeah, it was some of their complaints were, it was bigger than me. It's the baggage, especially with the Led Zeppelin mm-hmm. reunion stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's just baggage that I have nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And I'm part of something that is developing. That's a new thing.
Right.
That people aren't caught up to yet.
Right.
It's something. And now it's different because people have been catching up to it. There's you look out in the audience, you see the t-shirts and you see the look of hope that, you know, but
I had not seen the band before, and I wasn't really aware of you know the disgruntled camps, you know, wherever they lay. But I got the impression just seeing this show and hearing this band, it was very clear to me that this is its own thing. This is a completely separate thing with its own life and its own story and its own identity. And I'm here for it. Like,
yeah, that's the feeling that I had, you know, and because, on the first tour, T-Bone was in the touring band, and he was a constant reminder, not that he said anything, it's just having him there, that this thing is a new sound. This is a new thing that's developing, that's, you know, and it really hasn't, nothing directly tied to the past. You know, it's, we use, you know, you go backwards to move forwards kind of thing.
Right? Yeah. You talked earlier about, like, you know, when you're sitting behind Robert and kind of like the light hits his hair a certain way. And I'm in
that vantage point.
Yeah. Know, but I had the same experience from the front because, you know, for the most part, like I said, this is its own thing with its own identity. But there were just a couple of moments that I had that you described. Yeah. I was like, shit, he's still Robert Plant. He's like, there he is.
Yeah. And he takes that voice up.
Yes.
Know, that it's powerful, man.
Yeah.
It's
he really saves it like once or twice per set. You know, it's just.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really amazing.
No, it's the best seat in the house for sure. You know,
it's
such a gift. I'm so thankful to be in the middle of that. And not only in the middle of it, but being allowed this freedom to put my voice in the hat too. You know what I mean? Like they're very generous in, you know, opening the door for me to just go in and explore.
Yeah. It seems like
trust. There's a lot of great.
Sure. And you've been doing what you do long enough that. Like you said, it's kind of a casting thing. Like you get called to be you.
Right? Yeah, because I'm not interested in trying to chase anything else that has happened. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, there's never going to be another John Bonham, that's for sure.
Right.
You know, we can all learn from it, but you know, I don't want to be an impersonator.
Right. Right.
That's. I mean, some people are good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally fine. Me personally, I just love listening to as much music as possible and letting it all stew with whatever's going on in my brain and what I have to offer and move it forward or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I just love doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I love it more now than maybe when I was a kid, and I really loved it then. You know?
Right.
I mean, I'm more fascinated and tortured by it in a big way, and more of a student now than I when I was a student.
Right. Well, I think, you know, as it's true for anybody, pretty much, you know, as we get older, we become more and more of ourselves, hopefully.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, at this stage in your career, and especially on this gig, like you're really getting to be the most yourself that you've ever been.
Yeah, and you know, always working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to we hadn't been out in 14 years or so, you know, on the road.
Yeah.
The last time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was digging in and prepping for the material, listening to the old record and some of the old touring recordings, and then the new stuff, and putting it all together and trying to figure out how to approach it all. You know, it's like looking at old photographs of yourself.
Yeah.
When you go, I remember what I was thinking, but I'm not thinking that way anymore.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to figure out how to, again, move it forward, just approach those songs. You know, I put a lot of care and time into supporting the songs the best that I could in that moment,
mm-hmm.
way back then.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it stands up for me.
Yeah.
But there are things that I've figured out, too, that could be different now.
You know? Right, right. So you get to, like, implement that.
Yeah, there's an essence that I think, a sound that was created, mm-hmm. you know, as a whole. I just carved out, it helped me carve out a certain approach to playing drums.
A few months ago, before I went on this tour, I had the opportunity to play with Molly Miller in Atlanta. Yeah,
yes.
And your wife, Jen Condos, yes. came out with her, and what a couple of unicorns they are. That, I mean, it was such a great gig. It was such a fun, beautiful gig. So, like, you're the guy, you're the drummer in that trio with Molly Miller around here. And I do want to talk about Molly because her music and her playing is just so cool. But I want to talk about Jen.
Yeah.
Playing with her was just magic. And I'm curious about your just your relationship and how you know, the husband wife dynamic overlaps with the drums bass dynamic. And how you have sort of shaped each other musically and otherwise over the years.
We met playing together, and that was it. You know, I mean, not as far as getting involved romantically. It took mm-hmm. a few years, but musically, we were locked in from the very beginning. Mm. And just breathed together and played time together and just created a sound. And sonically, we're kind of landing a place that just creates this sound.
Yeah.
And we just don't talk about it.
It just is.
It's very rare that there's a conversation. And Jen always says that she only notices the drummer when they're not playing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, because people will comment, they'll say something about me, and she'll just go, honestly, I'm not listening to him. But she doesn't mean it like that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean.
I don't, at least, who knows. No, it's just, you know, it's when you're lost in it, and she definitely goes somewhere else when she plays.
Yeah, I could tell. Yeah,
just and super... very deep place, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and it was like I couldn't tell if she was like intensely, you know, in the moment in the room or just kind of somewhere else in her own time zone or kind of both at the same time. Like it was really amazing to be around.
She's whoever's what, you know, if it's a singer or a lead like Molly, or she's just focused on the song and the performance and how someone's playing and
right.
and where to dance around, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Musically.
Right. And I mean physically she does do a little bit of dancing back then.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I love it. So how did the two of you come to hook up with Molly?
That's a good question. We met her brother. I met her brother, Sammy, who's an incredible drummer and has a band, Sammy Miller and the Congregation.
Does he live here?
He's in New York now.
Okay.
But fantastic player and great band. Really cool. Great band. he was hanging out with Levon Henry, who's the son of Joe Henry.
Okay.
And I worked, Jen and I both have worked, that we met playing with Joe Henry mm-hmm. years ago. And I've done a lot of records over the years with him. And so we met Sammy and his parents. We got to know the parents. And I forget how... maybe Jen met Molly first and mm-hmm. started... they play every Monday night downtown.
Right,
this place, Perch.
Yeah, I know that place.
Yeah. And they've been doing it for years. So maybe that's what happened. And then I think Jen invited her over here to... she wanted to make a record. We ended up recording the first record that we did with the trio here.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the second one we did with Mike Persante in a studio here in Los Angeles at United Studios. But so I think we just started playing together. I think maybe we started playing here and just working on songs, and something just felt right about it.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
It's really fun. And I love instrumental music, and I think it's really hard to do. And some of the, like, the high bar instrumental bands for me, conceptually, the MGs, like Booker T and the MGs.
Yeah,
like
they
were such great arrangers when they were backup singers.
Yep.
And they had that sensibility when they played. If you listen to Green Onions, that is like one of the, I don't know, it gets tossed off as this novelty song, but it's deep. It's a really deep, it's one of the hardest feels. No one plays that feel right. When you hear cover bands.
Oh, yeah.
If I hear a cover band playing that song, I'm immediately running in the other direction.
Right.
And if we're on a gig and someone wants to play it, I refuse to play it.
Because they, we're not, you know, do what? It right.
When they played it live, they didn't play it as good as when they played it in the studio. Yeah. What they captured in the studio,
yeah, whatever,
is impossible.
That was. Yeah.
Because Al Jackson Jr. doesn't even play a swing beat. He's just playing quarter to quarter.
Right.
And that bass drum, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
And it's swinging so hard.
Yeah.
The whole thing. And everybody's playing the right parts and really economical. And as a whole, the machine is just...
totally.
It's rocking, man.
Totally.
That thing comes on the radio and it just... it's rocking.
I've really played hard. That song a ton of times, mostly with Ty Bailey. do you remember him?
He lived here for a while. Yeah, I sure do. Yeah.
And he loves playing it, and I love playing it with him. But the first time, he really did me a solid the first time we played it together, because I knew the song, obviously, and I had probably played it before, but you know, we were just doing like a bar gig, and he was like, "Let's do Green Onions," and he turned to me and he was like, "Quarter Notes on the Ride." And then he kicked it off.
Wow.
And I, like, I went back and listened to it after that gig, and I was like, shit, I never even realized, like, it's just quarter notes.
Well, it's great that he knows that and that he's using that as a guy, because usually you get, like, it's a shuffle.
Right.
Yeah, kind of. You know, it's a dangerous shuffle is what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking for myself.
Yeah.
It horrifies me to play that.
Right.
Because I can't.
Right. And I whenever I play it, I do quarter notes on the ride, but that doesn't mean that I'm getting it right.
There's some great live footage of those guys, and all the tempos were just pinned, you know, especially when they were playing with Otis Redding.
Sure.
He'd start off at a ballad tempo, and then all of a sudden, how did they get into this, you know? And Green Onions gets into that zone. It's still grooving and it's great, but there's something about that record version that it gets you going, man.
Yeah.
It's such a deep groove.
Well, and you talk about Molly's music and her compositions and instrumental music in general. Like, I feel like instrumental music for the most part, you know, especially in the last few decades, has been the domain of, you know, jazz, fusion, very complex, testosterone-laden music. But the Green Onions and Molly's music are examples of instrumental music that is so simple and so lyrical. I think instrumentalists, you know, as soon as they're playing without a singer, they're like, okay, let's
That's what I found, and that's why I didn't mean to go off on the tangent.
No, it was a good tangent. Any tangent about Booker T.
It's tied into, you still need to support the composition, and I love arrangements, and I love trios.
Yeah,
and when you have a trio, and I've done duos too, and I think it's really important what you don't play.
For sure.
Because when you do play something, it makes... And if you play something in the right spot, it makes... It gives you a broader bag.
Yep.
Like, you have more of a range. And you can get a lot more out of things when you're really thinking about what the song needs. Even if it's an instrumental... And someone's playing the melody on a guitar or a piano.
Yeah.
It's, to me, it's still the same as if someone singing a lyric.
Yeah.
You know.
And both in the case of Green Onions or any one of Booker T's songs or, you know, almost any one of Molly's songs.
Yeah, it's lyrical, like you were saying.
You could put lyrics to it. Like, they've written these melodies... And you could absolutely put lyrics to it.
So this trio is really based around trying to support the composition and arrange things. Molly's really good at arranging.
Yeah.
And she's good at taking jazz standards and putting her stamp and arranging them.
Mm-hmm.
But so Jan and Molly are writing together, and I think that's a really great combination.
It is.
And they're coming up with these really cool, and we all kind of sit down and arrange it eventually, but these really cool melodies and things, and it's really about making things starting from a place of simplicity,
mm-hmm.
and making sure that the song is the star, you know.
Yeah it's this really cool combination of sort of, because I especially on the last record, I think a lot of the tones and melodies and just the whole vibe of it is very Western influenced, very country Western, even kind of spaghetti Western.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But you know, their ability to sort of combine that kitschiness with, like you said, some depth and just trusting the simplicity of it. This phrase "trusting the simplicity" is rattling around in my head a lot, because the MD on Ain't Too Proud, the show I'm on, use that phrase just kind of in passing in a conversation,
which is a very difficult thing to do.
It really is But yeah, just this combination of sort of, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's also just so compositionally rich and you know, really cool music, and I was just really, really honored to get a chance to play it with them.
Great.
Yeah. So
yeah, they loved having you. They had a great time.
It was a blast.
It's exhausting.
What is
that gig sometimes?
Is it really?
I find it exhausting.
How so?
Molly is her energy level is
that's true.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's an age difference between the three of us, you know.
So
I have a hard time keeping up sometimes, but
yeah. And it's not that Molly's like, you know, all over the stage. There's just an intensity and such an intention about her playing.
Oh, she's very intense.
Yeah.
And what's coming out, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's delivered.
It's delivered. It sure is.
Really love that.
Yeah.
Is there more Robert and Allison traveling coming up?
Or? I think so. I think we might be out again in mid-April for maybe a month, and then take a couple weeks off and go out for another month.
Cool.
June into July.
And in terms of the time you spend at home, what are you, well, I mean, how do I want to phrase this question? Do you feel the need to stay busy when you're here, or?
No, in fact, I didn't book any work for myself. I turned a lot of stuff down when I was in the middle of touring, mm-hmm. because I didn't want to come back and be just catapulted into a whole other realm
right.
too quickly.
Right.
I wanted to savor and enjoy what had just happened, and also just be home and enjoy my home life.
Right.
With Jennifer and Basie, our dog, and just get caught up and then slowly let things unfold and get back into it that way. And that's what I did, and it's been really good. I like having the time to just practice again and mm-hmm. just sit alone in a room with a set of drums.
Yeah.
And get caught up.
Yeah.
You know, there's, yeah. I don't know, as I've gotten older, my practice time is more efficient because I've played so much. I've had so much experience playing now that I know what doesn't feel right to me. And I can work, I can immediately go and work on these things mm-hmm. And figure them out.
And are those things like musical, conceptual, or physical, or
both?
All of that?
Yeah, physical. You know, I've struggled with the physicality of playing drums my whole life because I didn't start off really playing a drum set. I started off playing bits and bobs around the house,
right.
buckets and pans and washing machines and. And I got used to the way all of that sounded,
uh-huh.
you know. So when I got older, before college, and got a proper drum set, I was really disappointed because a lot of those treated, you know, like a washing machine, sounds like a bass drum on a Phil Spector record. It sounds like it has chamber or reverb on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's that I would listen to those records, and I just. How do they do that? I didn't know anything about the studio or reverb or anything,
mm-hmm. you
know, or editing or overdubbing, and you know, I would sit endlessly trying to play a Stuart Copeland track, not knowing there were like 8 hi-hat overdubs and
right.
digital delay and all this kind of shit,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
going on. And I'm there in my little basement in Maine, trying to figure it out.
Oh fuck.
Which is great. I you know, it doesn't happen so much anymore because we can find out how to do anything we want to do
mm-hmm.
with the internet. You
right.
know? But I forget, was it Art Tatum or one of those great piano players? Art Tatum was blind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's the story that he learned from piano rolls that were played by 2 people,
uh-huh.
4 hands.
Right.
And he didn't know that.
Oh, my God.
So he just learned how to do that.
Right. Jesus.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I kind of fell into a little bit of that, too, not knowing studio was. But anyway, so the drums, when I got behind a drum set, working the bass drum pedal and hi-hat and I don't know, it just, it's always been rickety for me. I'm also a lefty that was started at a right-handed drum set.
Okay, yeah.
So I've always struggled with dexterity in my bass drum foot,
mm-hmm.
and I've always had this crazy active left foot, which is why I put shakers on my leg. And
right.
And I have a lot of strength. And if I had been a lefty drummer, I'd probably have like this monster foot, you know, bottom foot
right,
or something.
Right.
But not having, it's interesting, it just shifted having that weakness. And I don't know, to this day, like I can't, even the most basic things I can't do on a bass drum. That's why I play very simple. And I like having a big bass drum because you get a lot of bang for the buck.
Right, right.
So a nice, big, long, open tone. And if I have to do fancy stuff, I just I mute a floor tom, or sometimes in the studio I have a smaller version of this drum that has a goat skin on it, a smaller bass drum, and I'll just put it up near the floor tom, and I play bass drum patterns with my right hand, and have that be the main, and I'll tell the engineer, floor tom's the bass drum.
Right.
Bass drum is color. It's like it's extra support.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not where the motor is.
You know? Right. We talk all the time on the podcast about the physical aspect of things in general, but specifically like sort of identifying what your body wants to do and what it doesn't want to do, and building your sound around that. Guitarists talk all the time about how like your sound is in your hands.
Yeah.
And it's totally true for us too. Like our sound is in our whole body, and to an extent you have to work on stuff and train things and strengthen things, and you know, if there's a weak link in your chain somewhere.
Yeah.
But you know, there's really something to be said for not forcing your body to do shit that it just doesn't want to do. Leaning into the stuff that it does well, and it seems like you've really done that. Like you've built your sound around obviously what you want to hear, but just what you're physically comfortable doing.
Yeah, I have found ways of dealing with it.
Yeah,
you know, and I try to do it the way everybody else does it, and it doesn't work. You know, there are guys out there that just have incredible power and dexterity. I was watching this clip, and they had a side view so you could see his foot. I've actually seen him live, and I could see his foot, but Steve Gadd.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he was a tap dancer. He's got that totally. Rocking thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, I can't wrap my head around it. I mean, it's incredible. There's a balance problem that I have, you know, that, and I think it's because I sub, that's why, again, I use shakers on my left leg. I subdivide, you know, not always, because it depends on the tempo, how fast I can move my leg. But, and if I can't really do that, I feel really off base, and I can't. It's hard for me to play the bass drum. It's hard for me to play like double strokes and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but you know, I try to take chances and try to push out the notes sometimes and go for things I know I don't really know how to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes I get lucky. And
I was about to. I've had the exact same experience so many times. Like
yeah, I'm sick of being afraid of it. I was afraid for a long time of technically, no matter how much I practiced, it didn't seem to matter.
Uh-huh.
It still, my foot was just lame.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
So, but when you talk about you're sick of being afraid of it, like, does that mean that you sort of stopped going for shit that you knew wasn't going to happen? Or
no, it makes me just, it's like, what's the worst that could happen?
Right.
You know? I mean, the whole thing just collapses, maybe, but
I don't know, it's an old drum set. It's a possibility.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
But I want to keep trying, you know. And like this gig I did last night, it's just wide open. There's a lot of freedom, you know. And I really go for shit. I'm constantly falling off the cliff and making a bloody mess of myself. But it's fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah. Well, man, it was great talking to you. Thanks for having me over.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks for hosting in this super cool room. I wish you all, because I'm going to take a video of this room.
Yeah.
Because it's just, like, when I pictured, you know, the room that Jay Belarose spends time in, this is it.
This is it. I've lost a lot of hours in this chair. As you can tell, the way I'm sitting in it. This is what happened.
No, you haven't lost them. You've gained hours.
Yeah, right.
Great talking to you, man. Thanks
for coming. Yeah, likewise. Thank you. Appreciate it.
There you go, Jay Belarus. They only made one of him. It was an absolute pleasure getting to know him, both from the audience perspective and in conversation with him. If you're in LA, he plays frequently with the Molly Miller Trio, and look out for him in the rest of the world on tour with Robert Plant and Alison Krauss. Next week, Matt Krauss will be talking with Dan Ainspan, host of the Nashville Drummers Podcast. It's always great to talk with our friends in the drum podcast racket, so that should be cool. Until then, stay safe, stay sane, and thanks for listening. Cheers.